listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud. I love having a live accompaniment. Please give thanks and welcome to Tom Lutz and the Blue Tuna Band, Max Bangwell on drums, Michael B. Holden on bass, and Guitar Jack Wargo on guitar. We are so happy to have them here tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which brings you these Aloud programs, and we are thrilled to have you here tonight. Tonight is a collaboration with the Los Angeles Review of Books, of which Tom Lutz is the editor and founder. We are thrilled to work with them. We have a great roster of storytellers here for you tonight, and this is a great big experiment, and you are the lucky audience that gets to be here for the very first storytelling event here at Aloud, so we'll love to hear your feedback afterwards. And enjoy the show, stay for the reception, and now it is my great, great pleasure and honor to welcome your MC for tonight, Richard Montoya of Culture Clash.
How's everybody doing tonight, huh? Yeah. Wonderful to see that the latecomers are Anglo this evening, because usually that's reserved for Latinos. How's everybody? You having a good time, huh? Have you seen so many Chicano hockey fans in all your fucking life? How about this band, huh? All from the... They're from the Reform Synagogue just down the way, and they were let go tonight for just a two-hour furlough window, so hopefully they'll be joining us at the reception afterwards. And what a nice-looking crowd that you are. We hope to take you through the highways and byways of Los Angeles literature and make our way through places like Chavez Ravine and Silver Lake and Echo Park bars where we find hipster vampires doing battle with cholo zombies. And the Tea Party's pissed off because a cholo zombie is nothing more than a Mexican that will never die. And why, you know, we need to borrow a little evangelical fervor from the other side of the aisle this evening. And we want you to give these writers some love because, man, we've got some great writers. I am so amazed to be on this bill this evening because, you know, after all, here we are at the library, and we don't even have library cards tonight, okay? And while we're not going to burn it down, we are going to storm our way through the arts and leisure section of the library tonight. And... maybe find a bar down on 5th and Spring where the ghost of Bukowski might live. And if Kerry McWilliams led us to Chinatown, then there's our jazz, there's our L.A., there's our literature. All wrapped up nicely for you. And up in Red Hill, where I live now in Angelino Heights, while Upton Sinclair lived there. And I'm aware of these ghosts every day as I make my way to the hipster cafe with the 50 laptops with dark clouds hanging over them. And to be a writer in Los Angeles, my God, the literary landscape, the infuriating and the impossible and the possible. And I think you'll find a lot of that in each storyteller that we have this evening. And now comes my Michael Silverblatt impersonation. This is Michael Silverblatt from Bookworm. Thanks, Mr. Brecker. I heard that laugh. Distinguishable as it is. But I guess it was my class at East LA College, my 13th year there, and I learned some of the secrets about writing and why I'm so gosh darn taken by this town, and why with the boys in Culture Clash and as a solo playwright, thank you so much. Why we've been so obsessed with Chavez Ravine and Water and Power and American Night and other desert cities, and it's still a desert after all, and that LA's not for everybody, and nothing here is concrete except the river, you know. And why we don't just want to lead or borrow from Moorish literature, we want to actually add to it, you know, and take our place among it. And there's something about the palm trees and the theme park ride nature of Los Angeles that guides us daily. And our love of books. These books I'm holding here, some little Sammy French readers. Water and Power was read Monday night at the New York Theater Workshop in the Lower East Side of New York, and I'm so proud about that because it is, after all, an L.A. story. And with any luck, it will receive a production there. But American Night opens the Yale Rep season in September. A season, by the way, which has Paul Giamatti later in the season, and a season that just closed with Tracy Letts on stage, and he won a Pulitzer last year, I believe he did, for Other Desert Cities, I believe. Someone looked that up. Culture Clash, Oh Wild West, and why we are so taken with our writers that moved to the West, from the Beats to the Chicano Romantics, to people like my own dad, Jose Montoya, who crossed paths with Miguel Pinero. Even Fenimore Cooper and the great Western writers, you know, it all seems part of our work here. So I'm holding up these books for a specific reason. These books of Culture Clash are banned in the state of Arizona right now because of the Attorney General there. Humorous as it might be, Hector Tobar broke that story, and he called me one day. He says, you know, you're banned in Arizona. Hector, one of the great writers here tonight, the Cub reporter from the LA Times. Yeah. I think Hector has a blog or something, but a Cub reporter, as you know. But all going before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, because it's not just about Culture Clash and we're not victims at all. The children of Arizona high schools are, because what's also being banned is ethnic studies, queer studies, black studies, women's studies. All the studies are being banned in Arizona by a bright-minded attorney general who, when he made that decision, was the superintendent of the schools for the state of Arizona. So there's serious business tonight. There's wonderful business. There's light business. And I want you to give it up for a loud right now for having us all here tonight. Huh? Come on. Make some noise, damn it! Ah! Woo! Our first reader tonight, our first storyteller, is a columnist and a television personality and just a god-awful lovely lady. Please welcome to the stage warmly Miss Ellie Ward. Please, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay. So has anyone ever seen like a stray dog in traffic, and it's scared and it's going to get hurt and it's kind of gross and you don't want to scare it, but you're kind of like scared of it and it could maybe like give you a disease or like pee on you? Has anyone, like, that's happened to everyone, right? Right? Okay. So that happened to me recently. But it wasn't a dog, it was a lady. And I was driving down Beechwood Canyon and I was like, confession, terrible mood. Terrible mood. I had just gotten out of this breakup. I was sad. I was crying. I was listening to Adele. And I was on my way to Amoeba before it closed to purchase some gangster rap, because that is what I do. And I saw this silhouette of this woman on Beechwood Canyon, and she was frail and bent over a walker and just inches away from traffic. And I was like, that sucks. I can't deal with it. And I kept driving. And then I thought, like, whatever that lady is doing in the street at 10:30 at night on a Tuesday, it's like, it can't be good. There's nothing good that could be going on right now. She's like hauling in her garbage cans by herself. If she's like the oldest hooker on planet Earth, like, whatever's happening is perilous. And I should probably stop because it's a mitzvah and I'm not Jewish, but I am sad, and whatever, things can't get worse. So I pulled over, and I walked up to her, and she has this short, wispy white hair. She has big purple glasses and a floor-length purple bathrobe. She has a purple pocketbook, and she's wearing slippers, which are purple. And she is ancient. And it's like, imagine, just for visuals, just stick with me. Imagine if, like, a scientist could make a hybrid between a human being and a turtle and then dressed it as the artist formerly known as Prince for Halloween. That is this woman. So I ask her if she needs help, and she says that she doesn't know where she is. And she doesn't know how she got there. She does not know how long she's been there. So I ask her if she knows where she's going. She said she's trying to walk down to Hancock Park to an elementary school. And that's like, I mean, you guys all know LA, like Beechwood Canyon to Hancock Park. That's like a haul in a vehicular sense. But if you are behind a walker, that is like some Iron Man shit right there. I don't know who does that. So I consider the karmic repercussions of being like, well, good day to you, and just leaving. And I'm like, I can't do this. I have to stay. So I was like, do you need a ride? And she says, yes. And I just want to note at this point that she has the most cartoonish old lady voice you've ever heard. It's adorable. And it's like if life gave you network notes. I don't know if anyone writes for TV, but they'd be like, your old lady character's a little on the nose. You should tone that down a little bit. She's such an old lady. So I take her arm, and which is like balsa wood, and I lead her to my car, and within 2 seconds, she trips, she falls on the curb, she's on the ground, she's on the sidewalk, she's crying, she's moaning, she's holding her shoulder, it is late at night, I have stopped to help this woman, instead I am killing her, and the police report is going to look so bad, and I don't know what I'm going to do, so I stand over her, and I just say, are you okay? And she says, yes. And so I hoist her up, and she just clings to me like a kitten, and I put her in my car, and we start down to the school she's got to get to. We're going down Vine. And I don't want to be rude, but I let her know that there's a chance that this elementary school is not open. And I point to the dashboard, and it's like, it's 10:47 at night. Do you think they're open? And her face just, she looks like she's going to cry. Her face just crumples into like an accordion of sadness. And she says she thought it was morning. And you can feel her confusion, just like a knot in your own stomach. There's no one waiting for her at the school, ever. No one is expecting her. So I pull over, and I realize this woman has no idea what's going on. And this is like the most awkward first date ever, because I don't know what I'm going to do with her. And I'm afraid she's going to pee in my car. And I know that's the reason why I was afraid she was going to pee in my car is only because it was a new car, and I'm a bad person. And anyway, so I pull over, and I'm like, what am I going to do with her? So like a murderer, I was like, let's look through your pocketbook. And so she gives me her pocketbook, and I found an ID in it. Awesome. Her name is Cecile Hoffman, and she is almost 90 years old. And in her photo, she looks a little bit younger. She has the same big purple glasses, but we decide I'm going to drive her home. And so I ask, do you know where you live? And she recites an address. It's the same on her license. Awesome. So we head further into Hancock Park. I'm like, I'm a good Samaritan. So I'm driving. We get to this really beautiful old like Art Deco building, and she doesn't have her keys, which does not shock me. And she says that the manager has a spare. So she goes and finds apartment number one and raps on the door with her veiny knuckles, and the door swings open, and a man who is naked is there. He has a very modest bath towel around his waist, but for the most part, he is in the nude. And his belly is sweating, and he's breathing as though we have interrupted some kind of nocturnal exertion. I will not speculate as to what. And he sees Cecile, and then he looks at me, and he rolls his eyes, and then he slams the door in our face. And then through the door, I hear, just Cecile, I'll be right out. And I'm like, awesome. He knows Cecile. She's home. Okay, so we're mostly out of the woods here. And so I go and I sit Cecile down on a planner, and it's a nice little building. And I notice actually that there is a one bedroom for rent. It's like, this place is pretty dope. And I'm kind of looking for an apartment. I'm thinking, that's why this is happening. So I can find an apartment, and then we can be buddies, and I will check on her. And it'll be like my mid-30s will just like unfurl into this like Tuesdays with Maury, Melrose Place, Jennifer Aniston film. This is going to be awesome. And so a moment later, the manager comes out. He is wearing clothing, much to my happiness. And he pulls me aside, and he's annoyed. He says, this is the second time she has shown up here in the middle of the night since we moved her out. I'm like, wait, moved her out? She didn't live here? Cecile doesn't live here? Cecile did not live there. So, fuck. So, now what am I going to do? Actually, that apartment that was for rent, that was Cecile's apartment that she lived in for 20 years, that she still thought she lived in. So he asked me, you know, what are you a relative? And I say, no, I'm a stranger. I just found her on the street and I put her in my car and I took her to really, honestly, like the one place in Los Angeles where she could not be less wanted. There was really nowhere in the span of LA County where she could not be less welcome. So I walk back over to her and I ask if she's got her purse. Do you have any like letters, any mail in there at all? And she digs out an envelope and I see a yellow forwarding label to an address on Franklin Avenue, right near Beechwood, right near where I picked her up. There's an old folks home there. Of course that's where she lives. So I stepped out of earshot, which to like a 90-year-old is like 10 inches away. And I called the home and I said, hey, you know, are you guys like, you guys missing any human beings? Because I think I got one. I think it's yours. And they said she just must have peeced out via the front door in her pajamas when they just, I don't know, were watching, you know, syndicated reruns of Roseanne. I don't know what they were doing, but they missed that. And so now that I've taken her elsewhere, she's a missing person, so they're just going to holler at the LAPD. No big deal. So Cecile and I sit on a planter just waiting for the squad car to come and take her away, and we're just gabbing. We're just chewing the fat, just shooting the breeze. And she tells me that her birthday is coming up. She's going to be 90 soon. And I say, I will definitely visit you because I know where you live now. You don't, but I do. And she asks me if I'm married. And I say, funny, you should ask, because I couldn't be further from that in this particular day from any kind of commitment romantically. And she says that she got married 3 times. And then she says in this awesome, snarky old lady voice, and I wouldn't do it again. And I was like, Cecile is awesome. Like, in between these weird bouts of dementia, she's lucid and she's hilarious. And you could tell that when she was younger, she was beautiful and charming. And then I realize Cecile is my geriatric feminist spirit guide. That's why I met her. And I don't need a man. And it's okay. And I don't need to cry to Adele songs because it's okay to be alone. Because Gloria Steinem, look at her. A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. And then I remember that Gloria Steinem got married. And then I look at Cecile and she's shivering on a planter, trusting her life to strangers and cops. And I realize that that epiphany is garbage. So I'm epiphany-less and the squad car rolls up. And I hug Cecile and I fold her frail little body into the back seat, this hard blue, you know, plastic bench where junkies have just barfed and hookers have bled. And it's just so sad to crumple her up in that. And I'm trying not to cry for her and also for my own pride. And I tell her I'm going to see her in a few weeks on her birthday. And then as the squad car pulls away, I don't know what possessed me, but I just put my hand on the back window like a really cheesy Lifetime movie. I was like, why am I doing this? And then Cecile, because she's just plucky, just high-fived me through the window and they sped off. And I kind of realized I never got my gangster rap that night. Amoeba was closed, and I went by there, and I was bummed. And then I realized I don't really need the gangster rap. I kind of was in a pretty, pretty good mood after that. And my epiphany finally hit me, and it's one that I had. Everyone knows this is an epiphany everyone should have had and should keep close, that sometimes just to get out of your own funk, you just need to get into another person's funk. And that solves it. But I did go home and sign up for online dating because I don't want to die alone. Thanks.
One more time, ladies and gentlemen, Ali Ward. Now in the Queen's chair on Literary Row there. Just beautiful story. It was hookers bled and pimps what? Barfed. That is the new, yeah, that the mayor should adapt that underneath the LA seal, I think, from now. That's going to be a good one. I feel a little embarrassed because I sent an email to the lovely ladies of Aloud. Gee, you haven't used my photo anywhere. And then I'm at my favorite cafe and I open up the Big Out magazine. And much to my chagrin, there's my photo in the center of the ad for Aloud. And imagine my horror and how bad I felt about that. But at the same time, you outed me. So thank you so much. I'm in the Out magazine, so that's wonderful. LA Weekly, y'all. LA Weekly. Have you ever seen a mezuzah in a Boyle Heights doorway? Why? Because the oldest shul in the city is still in East Los Angeles. This is part of our literary journey, huh? And we'll be getting into that more and more, but I really have to bring out the next storyteller, and I think that you will be just dazzled. She is a juggler and a teacher and a founder of a wonderful place called Wordspace. Would you please welcome Brenda Varda? Brenda.
Freeway flyer, oh, I'm driving in my car. Freeway flyer, I'm traveling far and wide. Oh, freeway flyer, I feel so good inside. Freeway flyer, oh, I'm going, baby, I'm going now. I think you all know what a freeway flyer is. Maybe you do and maybe you don't. A freeway flyer is one who travels in their car to our far parts of Los Angeles, teaching the wonderful students in all of our wonderful academic institutions, who is not, repeat, not a tenured faculty. I am a freeway flyer. Now, often as a freeway flyer, you will hear things like, hey, professor, even if you're not. Hey, professor, you know that midterm we had? I'm sorry I missed it. Hey, professor, oh, you know, I got to miss class today because I got friends coming into town. Hey, professor, you know those assignments online? Gee, I lost my password. You hear all the excuses in the world. So the one story I wanted to tell you tonight was about Paula. Yes, Paula was one of my students. Paula requested a meeting with me. Now, students can request meetings, so I'm sitting in this very, very small room with white fluorescent lights and pockmarks on the wall. We're sitting about 2 feet apart from each other. And we're here because Paula, with a slight smile on his, her face, leaning back in his, her chair, wants to talk to me. Now, I say his, her, because I really don't want you to know who it is, and I say Paula because I don't want to give the name and have you deduce where this particular student is from. I'm maintaining their identity. Now, if you want to know a little bit more just about the freeway flying, about teaching, you do it like I did. You take one job when you're in grad school, when you're getting a secure job thing like an MFA, you know, a master's in fine arts, because you know that's a guarantee of employment when you're done with school. So you take this job because you think, hey, when I'm done with school, it's all going to be gravy from there. And then because somebody offers you another job, you take another job. And then you take another job, and pretty soon you're doing, like I'm doing, 356 miles a week, which means about 11.6 hours in your car traveling to various locations. But you still like teaching, and you still like your students. So Paula is sitting across from me, and Paula is here. It is the last week of the semester. I don't know if you remember the last week of the semester. He's finally talking to me. She is finally talking to me because they haven't turned in any assignments except for the first one. So there's all these little blank open boxes. And Paula wants to talk to me. And so we sit down. And I say, well, I guess I can show you what your grades are, and open up my computer, and I turn it around, and he sees all the empty boxes. And he smiles at me. He goes, I don't know. You know, when it comes to English, I just can't seem to write anything. I don't know. He has said, I don't know to me at least 1,000 times during the semester, always with the same smile. And then he always follows it up with, you know, I can write papers for other classes. I can write them for chemistry. I can write them for physics. I can write them for history. I just can't write them for English because I don't like metaphors. But he knows what they are. And I know that he can talk, and I know that he uses metaphors when he speaks, and I know that he can do things, and so I'm frustrated. I don't know what to do. And also, this is a private institution, right? A private college. And the main thing for me to do is to retain the student. You laugh. Retain the student because it's good for education, because we want them to learn, because we want them to participate, because we want them to get to the edge of the quarter, because we want $25,000 to $40,000 a year in tuition. I must retain the student. Well, this becomes particularly difficult at this time because, as I said, Paula is one of my lowest performing students. In this particular class with Paula, this is a while ago, but I had a student from, and this is, I don't kid you not, this was, you know, for somebody who likes living in Los Angeles because it's a place where everybody comes together, this class had a student from Switzerland, Germany, Poland, Egypt, Russia, India, China, Indonesia, Japan, Venezuela, Mexico, Canada, and California. It was dizzying all quarter long. I mean, it was fun, though, you know, because you can take things from all these places and try to put it together. But Paula was at the bottom of the heap here. So I ask him, I go, what would you like to do? And Paula says, well, I don't know. Sometimes I know that teachers like some help, and maybe I could help you. What? He says, well, you know, I could make maybe something easier for you. Silence in the room. Even the air conditioner is listening. I'm not quite sure what to do in this moment. This may be the first time that perhaps this type of negotiation has happened. And I say, what exactly is it are that you are proposing? And he goes, well, I know that you don't make too much money. Now, this is embarrassing at this point. You don't want this pointed out to you in front of a student. You know, you already feel like a servant or a slave. You know, you're something like a tutor to the king, and maybe your head's going to be chopped off. So I say, we're here to talk about your grade. And he says, well, look at your computer. And I look at my computer, the one with the missing keys and the duct tape on the corners. He goes, oh, you know, I have an iMac, and iMac is much better than a crappy HP. So, this is coming out right now. And I'm going to tell you right here, I might have to step back from the microphone. I do want an iMac! I do want an iPad! I do want a longer vacation. I do want incredible job security. I do want everything to be in nice packages the way that I thought it would be after getting an MFA. And in all of these places, I think that maybe something is going to happen because I pay wonderful attention to my students and I give them good critique and I make them think about critical thinking and creative thinking. And I try to put their papers together and I try to mark the run-on sentences and the fragment sentences and the prepositions and the articles and the verbs. And I know that he's sitting here looking at me and he really doesn't care. And all I want to say to him at this moment, you know what I really want to say? I say, why don't you pay somebody to write that paper for you and don't bother me about it. Get somebody to fill in the blanks and just don't come to me and bribe me. But I don't. I say simply, well, Paula, I think maybe you should finish these assignments by Monday and then we can talk about your grade. And he goes, yeah. That is good. I'll change his accent just for the heck of it. That is good. I don't know what I can do, but perhaps. And he gets up and he grabs his stuff. He leaves a flyer for an iMac on my computer. And he says, I know people. And he turns and leaves. I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm not sure if it's a threat or a promise, but I do know that I probably can't take a bribe as an educator. You get into this business, and you think it's a good thing, and you think that this wonderful relationship between students and teachers. And I think about the assignments I missed, and I think about the assignments I didn't finish, and I think about the things that I wasn't happy with when I was a student, but I don't know if I would ever have gone that far. But any case, I did talk to the powers that be, and we did talk to him and gave him 3 weeks to finish his assignments because he must be retained. But he didn't finish them, and I got to fail him. 1, 2, 3, 4. Freeway flyer, I got my coffee in a cup. Freeway flyer, oh baby, I'd be just enough. A freeway flyer, I'll just keep driving in my car. Freeway flyer, I'm going far, 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 I'm going far.
Brenda Varda, ladies and gentlemen, un aplauso, por favor. Sitting in chair number 2 in the darkened literary row. Great. This next gentleman is a wonderful storyteller, a composer, a musician, an actor, and a writer. Please welcome Philip Littell. Philip, senor.
So I moved to L.A. to get into movies, and my friend Ray Allen takes me to the Theatricum Botanicum in Topanga, California, to meet the Gears. My life changes. Anybody here know what the Theatricum is? Yes! My God! Okay, that shortens the story. For those of you who don't know, it's just simply the most astonishing outdoor theater in America, I think. And it's, if you haven't gone, go. But at that point, it was really a hole dug in a canyon with railway ties and a lot of craziness going on. It was, you came there Saturday to rehearse and Sunday you did the play. Ha ha. A few Saturdays. Someone hadn't shown and they handed me the script and it was this part in Merry Wives of Windsor, and I just ran down the hill, top of my voice, shouting gibberish, and I was in. And it was the great love of my life, this theater. This was the romance made real. And since it was the 70s, there was a lot of romance in the air. This little group of people, you know, with Will Gear sitting there laughing his head off, making us funny, and Ellen Gear very quietly, very steadily, very brilliantly directing these anarchists. And it started to gel. And finally, we had a production where everything came together. It was The Taming of the Shrew, and we were all insanely funny. I had a very tiny part that I basically took over a lot of real estate with. And, you know, we were allowed. And not only were we in love with each other, we were in love with ourselves. And I can break it down. Basically, the women in the company were brilliant and hardworking and meticulous and insanely talented and the most gifted actresses you'd ever seen. And the men were all bad boys. Really, really bad boys. Basically, it worked. You know, you had these sort of Barrymore-esque drunks doing what Barrymore-esque drunks do brilliantly, which is Shakespeare, and then these great women. So we had this huge, huge hit. And as love kept blossoming, the worlds of Topanga started to fall in love with each other, the worlds of music, of politics, and a love took shape between Peter Alsop and Ellen Gear. To mark this union, which has lasted until today, which flourishes, of a folk singer who specializes in children's songs and this great actress and director, he wrote her a musical. And it was called Barnyard Sweets. And it was a children's musical, but for adults, And then the Taming of the Shrew cast was let loose on it. So you can imagine what that thing was. And Peter's a very funny man and a very loving man and a slightly malicious man, which is why I like him. And he'd written it to star Ellen, and he wrote her the toughest part on earth, which is a really good person. She was a blind mole. We were all animals. A blind mole. And I was a bee, hopelessly in love with her, and the malice there was that it was a straight bee. And one of the great Barrymore drunks was a homosexual wasp. Anyway, we all had a lot of fun with it. And while all this love and fun and craziness was going on, Ellen was trying to keep this thing going and grow it and make it into what it is today. So she looked for gigs, and she found a gig, and we had a gig. And the gig was Chino Men's Prison. And the choice was made to take Barnyard Suites. And yeah, we'll do it. And, you know, I guess, you know, it's an improving story. And so we were carefully, you know, structured about how to be in prison and, you know, what to do, what not to do, what to expect. And we got on the buses and we went and, you know, we were going to do theater for these poor guys, you know, just in jail. So sad. And so we walked into this prison and I have never seen so many sexy men in my life. There was more testosterone in the air than I have ever felt before or since, and I'm a veteran of many big gay events. The other thing was is that with all this energy, you were X-rayed. There was nobody who walked into that environment who was not seen by this collective totally for who they were, what they are, what they're about, what you were seen. Bzzzt, they had you. And so we started the show. And, you know, it's sort of going, they're bored. We were all self-costumed. And because Topanga's very hot in the summer, and it wasn't Shakespeare, we were wearing as little as possible, and the women, oh, they're gorgeous, and I had it's a bee, so black yellow striped T-shirt, black tights, very tight shorts with a little yellow and black bullseye, and a stinger, and I'm going to give you a flavor of the show, okay? Because this is a song I still remember. It's mine. The queen, she craves my body, but her face gives me the hives. I know she's somewhat odd because she eats her mates alive. She says she'll never harm me, but her fetishes alarm me. I know my stinger's much too small. Oh, yeah, that was a laugh. For her coronation ball, oh, the queen, she craves my body. Well, you can't fight City Hall. Well, I got away with it. And the story continued, and, you know, it's a quest, and I don't remember what it's about, but it's a quest, and it's an adventure, and we have adventures. And at one point, the wasp declares his love for me, and I have to sing a song called Hopelessly Heterosexual. And I'm not going to inflict it on you, but oh, boy. Oh, boy, getting through that song, because they knew. they knew. It did not go well. And maybe it's because I didn't have my rope to swing on that I had out in Topanga. And But we're getting to the end, and gratefully, because it's getting, the guards are kind of, and of course I sacrificed myself to save Barnyard Suites, and I sting, the enemy, and of course I have to die. My stinger is gone, and so I have, researched bee death, and observed, and I milk it a little, and then I die with my legs in the air. Have you ever seen a dying bee sneak its legs down? Thank you.
Señor Philip Littell, un aplauso otra vez, por favor. Will Geer, wow, man, that's awesome. Awesome, yeah. Welcome to an Ethnic Prairie Home Companion. Are we having a good time out there? How about our smoking hot band, Tom Lutz and the boys, huh? Guitar solo time. Bass solo time. Drum time, Max. How about tickling the ivories there, Tommy boy? Man, we're one step away from the Junkie Motel on Sunset where the Lords of Dan. I'm not afraid of those bars. I'm more afraid of Valencia and CalArts, but that's a whole nother matter. A native Angeleno, one of the first African-American columnists for the Los Angeles Times, a journalist, essayist, writer, teacher, professor, please welcome to the stage a lady so fine they had to give her three names, Erin Aubrey Kaplan, ladies and gentlemen.
When I moved to the house I live in now, in Inglewood, in 2004, I was ambivalent. My husband and I were moving to this house from a village of townhouses in Inglewood called Briarwood. In the eternal time warp of Briarwood, the grass never grew beyond a certain length, and people didn't hang out outside because there were rules against doing both. There were a whole lot of rules. Of course, that was the main appeal of the place, the rules, the climate control, especially in Inglewood, where there was a threat of chaos, even in the choicest neighborhoods. So I was ambivalent. But it was 2004, and my husband was convinced, like the rest of the country, that owning a home was the mark, the real mark of making it, the pinnacle of American adulthood. So I thought about it. As the date approached, I was nervous. I mean, I grew up in and around Inglewood, and so I was very familiar with the elements of chaos. Then I started to warm to the idea. I realized in Briarwood, in the bubble of Briarwood, nothing happened. It was a bubble. It was kind of hermetically sealed. And, Briarwood kind of stood, like most gated communities, as this symbol of suburban detachment. But in Inglewood, it almost stood as a kind of hypocrisy. Of course, the residents of Briarwood, including myself, I guess, we thought that we had a great place. We thought it was a role model of good living. It was stable, it was uneventful, it was boring. This was a role model not just for the rest of the city of Inglewood, but for the entire black population of Southern California, which was struggling to maintain not just its cohesion, but its idealism. You see, in Briarwood, the trains ran on time, the grass got cut, the pool got cleaned, the community center got swept, whether it needed it or not. So getting ahead of decay and decline. Well, that was like, you know, nothing better than that. But, so, when the time came, I was ambivalent. But I did start to think about this move, and I started to think about the kind of possibility and expansion and kind of adventure that might happen. A kind of sense of adventure I'd given up living in this bubble of Briarwood for 3 years. So I started to think about what that meant. I mean, in the house, we could hang out outside in the front yard. Then there was a backyard and all the promise of movement, you know, that was there. And we could keep our garage door up all day if we wanted to, which, of course, you can't do in a gated community, which is kind of infantilizing and disempowering. So I started to get kind of excited about this. And I thought to myself, you know, in a house, in a real house, we could be ourselves. Anything could happen. I mean, anything could happen. And this phrase that normally struck fear into the heart of most good life-seeking people, especially Black people, really started to feel to me like a good thing. So we moved. So the first thing that happened was a neighbor came up to me with a potted plant and a note card signed by the entire block club. This was great, very encouraging, a sign of Briarwood-like civility. This is great. The next thing I remember, maybe a few days later, I'm looking out of the front window, my big front window, looking out into the bend of the block. You know, the street kind of does an L, and it was designed that way in 1953 to make it look homey and kind of encompassing. And I look out on the block, and there's a woman walking in the middle of the street. She's petite, dark skin, slight, almost delicate. She's got very short hair, and she's kind of leaning forward as she's walking, kind of almost half up on her feet, like a reminded me of a T-Rex, you know. And she's talking very energetically and kind of profanely to herself. And as she's walking, she's snatching low-hanging leaves off of trees, and she stops and picks at the bark until it falls off. And I think, oh, must be a vagrant, you know, wandered in off of Crenshaw, which is the main drag, you know, a couple blocks away. And I feel kind of, you know, being, you know, socially active and everything, I feel a surge of sympathy and empathy for this woman, but I feel a stronger surge of certainty that she can't stay. She's got to move on, you know. She does not belong here. Well, I couldn't have been more wrong. The neighbor who gave me the potted plant confessed to me later that the woman in the street with barefoot was a neighbor too. She grew up here. She lived across the street from me, from us. The story goes that Claudia was a really promising girl, bright, affable, smart, personable. She got a scholarship to college. And not too long before we moved there, something really bad happened in college. Some neighbors said it was some bad drugs. Others said it was just some kind of flat-out evil. But Claudia came home to recover, and she didn't. And the neighbors kind of reluctantly starting accepting the fact that maybe this bright girl of promise was not right, and she might never be again. But that's kind of all they said. What I noticed is that they stopped short of saying anything like mentally ill, schizophrenic, kind of like they never talked about what Claudia was actually doing. Because sometimes, you know, she wasn't just walking and talking. She would get loud or she would get threatening, but nobody ever talked about that. So I started to realize that in order for the community to keep Claudia in it, they had to make her not invisible, but inconsequential. Kind of like an item that came up on our monthly block club meetings, like, you know, replacing, oh yeah, we got to replace the sign that went missing at the end of the block, or, you know, we got to get the street repaved, we got to bother city council about that. But we never actually did anything about it, we just talked about it. So there was an acknowledgement, but that was it. And that was where Claudia kind of lived, in that space. And, well, I couldn't really do that. Claudia was not just not inconsequential to me. She was fascinating. Not really in a good way. I mean, at first, I would look out of my window practically every day and see her and just get furious that she was mocking my expectation I had of this great little society that I was hoping to live in or recreate. And there she was. And then, you know, time went on, and it became very clear that Claudia wasn't going anywhere. Kind of against my will, I started to admire her. Because, you know, after 2004, it turned out not to be a great time to buy a house in a working class neighborhood. The economy was bad. It got worse. 2008, it got real bad. And the houses in this wonderful neighborhood that we moved into, a lot of them sank into foreclosure, got empty. I lost my job. Other people did too. But, you know, day after day, there was Claudia doing her thing, making her rounds, keeping vigil. I even started to admire how she dressed for the job. I mean, she often didn't have shoes, but she often looked in a kind of thrown together way with a kind of child's lack of attention to the details of color and coordination. She looked really stylish. You know, she had vest over shirt, she had a robe over pants, but it somehow looked together. And it looked creative and innovative. And I started to get weirdly jealous. I mean, I would go every day, go into my closet, figure out an outfit, and I wasn't really going anywhere or doing anything. And I thought, wow, well, Claudia might have gotten waylaid in college. I got waylaid somewhere in high school on some emotional level. So anyway, I really started to kind of accept her and these new rules of this neighborhood. But, you know, she never talked to me, and I started to resent that. She talked to other people. She, you know, she would acknowledge them. She would look them in the face, but not me. And I didn't quite know what to do about that. But one day, I heard something in the middle of the afternoon. I heard yelling. It was her, and I'd heard her yell before, but this sounded different and urgent. So I ran outside, and there she was in the middle of the street, in the bend of the block, on her toes, going as far forward as she could without falling, yelling at her mother, right in her mother's face. I couldn't make out everything she was saying, but what I caught was, "You don't know me. I was something. I did something. I was somebody. You don't know. You don't know what I lost. You don't know. Do you? Do you?" She was so angry. And I was kind of so fascinated, I forgot to ask her mother if she wanted me to call the cops, which I don't like to do. You know, she didn't talk to me, and she hasn't talked to me yet, but she spoke to me that day because I understood her frustration at, you know, what had happened. She didn't know what had happened in her life. It didn't seem like she knew, and she was getting it out. And so, anyway, none of this means that I've made peace with all this. I mean, 8 years later, I still look out of my window, and there she is. I don't know what to feel about Claudia. I don't know what to feel about my neighbors who've accepted all this and kind of, you know, are abiding by these rules. But I'd really like to change the scenario. I'd like to see some progress, you know, like all that, but I don't know how to change it. And, you know, the bottom line is none of my business. And most of all, Claudia lives here. There are no rules against walking, talking to yourself, getting mad. Maybe there should be less rules against that. So I can only say that it's just the inconvenience of living in a real house. And for Claudia, it's just like watching the pain of having too much freedom in the real world.
One more time, ladies and gentlemen, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. Let the story resonate. Let the story resonate. Man, I think I'm at the gospel brunch at House of Blues right now. Topanga, Inglewood, Franklin. Oh, we're moving. We're moving through the city, beyond the grid. Ooh. Amazing. It's Chinatown, Jake. There was the Mother Ditch was an irrigation ditch in Chinatown, and whoever controlled the valve of the Mother Ditch was in control of the entire desert pueblo known as La Ciudad de Nuestra Los Angeles de Porzúncula. So here we are. 1918, I'd been fascinated with the Magón brothers. Ricardo Flores Magón and his brother were anarchists from Mexico, because I've been really obsessed with hipsters lately in my neighborhood. And because I'm not a native Angeleno, in a sense, my wife and I, we are hipsters also, because we're new, relatively, 25 years in L.A., but it feels like my town finally, my literary town. And you dutifully go through the town with your James Ellroy novels, and the companion to that is City of Quartz and Mike Davis, and you're saying, wow, there's the hotel, and there's the bar, and there's the county jail, and there's Beverly Hills. And why any writer doesn't write about Los Angeles is beyond me, because we're just fascinated by it. But the Magón brothers are exiled out of Mexico, and they find a cooperative of anarchists in the Echo Park area where the Tom Mix Studios used to be. And they write, and they help write the Plan de Ayala, which inspired Zapata and his troops to go on. And this is the time of Eugene O'Neill and John Reed and Diane Keaton looking hot in Reds. Yeah. But watch Reds again, man. What a great reminder of why we became progressives in the first goddamn place. Reds is a great movie, man. So, yeah, Magón, Eugene O'Neill, John Reed, and Diane Keaton. That's nighttime material right there. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to the stage a new cub reporter for the LA Times and one of the most important writers, daily columnist writers in America, I believe, Guatemalteco, un chapín de Guatemala, Héctor Tovar, ladies and gentlemen.
This is a story about my mother. I am my mother's only son, only child, and it's been my burden to carry this story for 20 years. My mother was married 3 times. The first time to my father, wonderful father, but a womanizer. She found him at Griffith Park with another woman and divorced him. Her second husband was Mexican-American, Chicano. He was like a mestizo Burt Reynolds. Muy guapo. Sideburns of the day, chiseled features, but an alcoholic. Drank himself to death, pobrecito. Eventually, drank himself to death, literally. Que descanse en paz, as we say in Spanish. So she divorced him before he killed himself with alcohol. Her third husband neither drank nor womanized. And I know this because I'd go out to dinner with the two of them, and he would order milk. And because I happen to know, because my mother told me, that my mother was his first and only girlfriend in life. When she met him when they were both in their 40s. He was a very incredibly shy person. David Dodson was his name. A very nice man, a gun collector, and a Republican. But when he talked to my mother about me, he called me the kid. And I was like the son he never had. Wonderful man, eccentric. He just loved my mother. They were, you know, the great love of each other's lives. In fact, my mother, of her 3 marriages, only had 1 honeymoon. And that was the one that Dave gave her. They went to the Mississippi River and had a honeymoon. So my mother loved Dave, and he loved her back and wanted to build her dream house. So he sold his business in Los Angeles, bought a piece of property in a development in Sedona, Arizona, and they built a house together, and they even designed it themselves with a spiral staircase in the middle and a big picture window that looked out of Cathedral Rock. And they went out there to Arizona to live happily ever after. Dave started a rotor-rooter business to pay for the new house and to pay for his new wife's, lifestyle, and they lived well. I, meanwhile, this is in the early 1990s, was in my late 20s, and I became a reporter at the LA Times, and I had a little house in Silver Lake. And one day, I get a call on the phone, and my mother says, "We're on the highway, we're coming from Arizona. We need to tell you something when we get to Los Angeles." I said, okay, Mama, my mother is kind of dramatic, but I didn't expect anything that dramatic. So they get to my house, and they sit on my couch, and they say, we're running away. I said, what? These are two people, remember, in their early 50s. I'm in my 20s, late 20s, and they're telling me they're running away because Dave has committed a crime, a financial crime. He has defrauded a bank to keep his business afloat. So they are going to run away to Guatemala because Dave is convinced that the FBI is going to come after him and they're going to prosecute him and throw him in jail for a financial fraud of about $1 million. So I, you know, laughed this off and I said, wow, Dave, it's pretty good for a Republican, you know. And they left LA and went to Guatemala, and they lived with my mother and father are Guatemalan immigrants, and they lived with my grandfather in Guatemala in La Zona 7 of Guatemala in a working class district called La Colonia 6 de Octubre, where Dave thought he was living incognito, but where in fact he was known as El Gringo. So my mother calls me one day from Guatemala, and I'm back in L.A., and it's a few days before Thanksgiving weekend, and she says, Hector, Dave is coming to L.A. He's going kind of crazy. He has this whole plan for going to Los Angeles in a way that the police won't get him, but he has some business to do there, so he's going overland through Guatemala, crossing on a boat to Belize, taking a bus through Belize, crossing by foot into Mexico, flying from Cancun to Tijuana, then walking across the border with only a briefcase in hand as if he were a gringo tourist, and walking back into Los Angeles. So you might see him in LA in the next few days. So I go about my life thinking, you know, well, my crazy stepfather might be here and we might talk about his business adventures or whatever in Guatemala. And so he, I go about my life. And finally, it's the Friday, it's the Saturday after Thanksgiving. And I go out to dinner with my best friend. My best friend is my dear friend, Virginia Espino. And so we go out to dinner at El Conquistador in Echo Park. And we have a nice conversation, and I'm going to drive Virginia back home because we're really just platonic friends. Actually, she was my ex-girlfriend at that point, but we were very platonic friends. And I said, I'm going to just, do you mind if on the way I drop you home, I'm going to stop by my house and check the mailbox because, check my phone because Dave might have called and there might be a message. I get to my house, and I automatically open the mailbox first, and there's a letter. There's no message on the machine, but there's this thick letter that has a return address for Whittier, California, and has the return name of David Dotson. So I open up this envelope, and it's this bizarre rant about, by the time you read this, I'll be dead. Ha, 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 ha. I showed them all, kind of a very, very disturbing letter. And I realize that it's a suicide note. So at that time, I am in fact, cub reporter. I am a reporter for the LA Times. And so I have, in those days, we had Rolodexes. So I have a Rolodex with all these emergency contact numbers, and I have a night number for the coroner's office. And being an intrepid person, I think, well, if he really is dead, I'll be able to find out by calling the coroner's office. So I call the coroner's office, and I said, excuse me, hi, I'm Hector Tobar from the LA Times, but I'm not calling as a reporter, I'm calling because my stepfather wrote me this letter that looks like a suicide note, and I want to know if he's dead. So the coroner person there, he says, oh, yeah, I'll check. Just wait a second. A few minutes pass, and he says in a tone of, as we say in Spanish, muy frío, very cold, he says, yeah, we got him. So things flash before my eyes, and I realize almost immediately that I have the responsibility of calling Guatemala and telling my mother that her husband is dead. And I know that this is going to be a difficult thing for her to hear, obviously, and so it's 10 o'clock at night, Saturday night, and I think I can't tell her right now. She'll be up all night. I have to tell her in the morning. In the morning is the better time to hear this news. But I also realized that I'm going to have to spend the whole night with this news in my head. So I asked my best friend, Virginia Espino. I say, Virginia, please, can you stay with me? I just don't want to be alone. And Virginia, very sweetly, sleeps on the bed. I am up all night, sitting up, pacing, thinking about how I'm going to have to tell this to my mother in the morning. The morning comes around. Virginia is waking up, and I pick up the phone, and I call Guatemala, and I don't get my mother on the phone, thank God. Instead, I get my aunt, and I said, Tia, oh, I'm so sorry, but Dave, you have to tell my mother Dave's killed himself. And yes, you know, she said all kinds of crazy Catholic things that I can't remember. But, she said, don't worry, I'll tell her. And then, of course, my aunt, thank God, my mother heard this news from a person and not from a phone, which I think is probably a better way to find these things out. And, you know, there was this sudden heaviness in everything in our lives. And my mother, of course, was going to fly up from Guatemala to Los Angeles to claim the body. In the meantime, I got back on the phone with the coroner's office and found out that Dave had killed himself at Rose Hill Cemetery in Whittier. And so I go out to Rose Hill Cemetery, and I, of course, there's people cutting the lawn, and of course, they speak Spanish. And so I said, disculpe, mi padrastro se mató aquí en el cementerio hace dos días y quiero saber si escucharon algo ustedes. You know, I don't know what drove me to go back to go to this place, but some sort of innate perverse curiosity and sense of closure that I was looking for, I don't know. But I went and I talked to the gardeners and they said, oh yes, we saw him, senor. He was this man, he came up walking with his briefcase and he knelt down in front of this grave and then I turned away and I heard a gunshot and I turned back and he was on the ground. So I walk over to the grave and it's the grave of his aunt. His Irish aunt, who had raised him. He had been born with one leg shorter than the other and had been teased mercilessly as a boy, had had to use crutches, and you know, and this aunt was the woman who really took care of him. So he went to go. When he left this world with her. So I go, I look at this place, and there's blood on the grass. And not only is there blood on the grass, but thank you very much, Los Angeles County Coroner, there is the shell of the shot that he fired to kill himself. Great job they did there of recovering that evidence. So I took this and I put this in my pocket and I went home. And the rest of the next 2, 3 weeks, months, years, decades were filled with this, well, especially the first years were filled with this incredible sense of mourning. My mother buried Dave at sea, very small ceremony. I was there. There was 4 of us. His ashes, we split him on the ocean. It was very sad. And, you know, suicide is this horrible, horrible thing. Because it's like each one of us has this landscape, this in our heads, this forest. It's like an evergreen forest. And it's this beautiful, comforting place that we want to be in. And when someone commits suicide, it's like they drop napalm on it, because that's what you feel like. Everything is burning and consumed, and there's ashes. And you live in this desolate place because someone has left this world violently, taken their own lives. And so we spent years dealing with this pain. I, myself, eventually went into therapy over this for the first time in my life, and I really needed to do that. I recommend that to anybody who goes through something like this. Really, really. It's good to talk to a person about it who's not part of your family, a person paid to listen, to be disinterested. So, no, I tell that. I'm now doing this book on the Chilean miners, and I tell that to the miners. Go talk to somebody about it who's not your wife, you know? Talk to somebody. So, Dave left 2 insurance policies, life insurance policies, and I did not know these existed, but they both had suicide exclusion clauses, so that if you killed yourself before a certain date, they wouldn't pay. And Dave waited until after the date. One of the policies was for $1 million, and the other policy was for $800,000. And the $1 million policy paid off all of his debts, essentially erased his crime. The other, for $800,000, was for my mother, so that she could live the rest of her days in peace and happy. And for Dave, that was loving her, even though he had left us all so violently. And my mother took this money and built herself a house in Guatemala that was an exact replica of the house in Arizona, with the same picture window and the same spiral staircase. But she had a lot of money left over after that, and she built houses for other people, friends, relatives. And so, thanks to Dave's act, maybe a dozen Guatemalan families got homes in Guatemala. And something else happened that was unexpected, which is that this friend of mine, Virginia Espino, who spent that night with me when I was in need and in agony, well, I got to know her better, and I realized that not only was she intelligent and beautiful, but that she was good. And that was the most important discovery of my life, was realizing this person's goodness. And to make a long story short, she and I, a few years later, became married. And we now have three kids. We have a family of teenagers and a 7-year-old girl. Our family has grown, and our family was born in this crazy act that my kids have no idea took what it felt like, what took place then. So that forest that I had in my head that had the napalm dropped on it, all the trees burned, well, it grew back. That's what happens. That's what happens. That's what human beings can do. Human beings are resilient. My mother found peace in the church, in working in the church, in making other people feel happy. Thank God she never got married again. But she found a way forward. So that forest I had in my head, most of it grew back, and it never does go back completely. There's still that one charred tree that's there, and there's still those ashes and cinders. And after a while, you realize that it's still a beautiful forest, even with that one scarred tree. So that is what I've learned from that, the resilience of life and the beauty of life. And one day, if I see Dave up there, I'll tell him the whole story. Thank you.
Hector Tobar, ladies and gentlemen. Woo! Smoke. Scorched earth and Rose Hills. Man, that's where water and power play ends in Rose Hills. Not that it's about me, it's about you, my man. I would march in the streets for this man, one of the greatest American columnists today, and joining the row of literary figures over there. I don't know how the word plutonic translated in Spanish when he said it. I was like, I didn't hear it, but I heard it. Like plutonico. It's like fornicando. Plutonico. But what a happy ending. It wasn't about the game at all. It was about this relationship. Oh, my God. I started going to therapy, Hector, because Latino culture, we don't do that. We do talk to our loved ones, but I realized when I started when I wanted to start a self-hate group, I needed to talk to somebody, and it's like the Chicano, like the Cholos I meet sometimes. Yeah, man, I got shot 13 times. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's like, after the 7th bullet, you were pretty much in the right place at the right time. Our next storyteller is a teacher and a writer, and I was just so taken by her story when we rehearsed on Monday night. Would you please give a warm welcome to our final storyteller this evening, Miriam Gerba. Ladies and gentlemen, Miriam.
When I attended UC Berkeley, I used to self-publish a comic book about a disembodied crime-fighting breast. And it was called The Adventures of Super Boob. I sold this comic on consignment at Comic Relief, and I went there one foggy afternoon to collect my earnings. The cashier handed them to me, and I wandered the comic book shop, wondering what I would spend my money on. The true crime bookshelf drew my attention. I walked to it, and I pulled a thin book from the shelf. the book was Death in Paradise, a pictorial history of the Los Angeles County's Department of the Coroner. I opened the book and I autopsied it. And I stopped turning the pages when I arrived at a grotesquely enthralling array of photos. Half of them were of a beautiful woman, Elizabeth Short, alive. The other half of the photos were of Elizabeth Short cut in two. And it looked as though the entire Spanish Inquisition had happened to her body. I was paralyzed by what I saw. I was paralyzed by the photographs, and I was paralyzed by the story and the legend of the Black Dahlia. I bought the book, and I went on to look for every morsel of Dahlia lore. I became a Dahliaologist. My life continued happening. I fell in love with a white butch girl at a lesbian bar. We moved in together. I graduated from school. Most of my friends did too. And slowly they began to leave for New York and Atlanta and DC. And my girlfriend and I discussed leaving Berkeley too. I mentioned to her, maybe we should move to Long Beach. My sister lives there. I didn't tell her, because she's sensitive and easily frightened, that I was also drawn to Long Beach because I knew the Black Dahlia had lived in several hotels there. I also knew that a pharmacist in Long Beach who had often seen Elizabeth Short walking the seaside streets, dressed all in black, had nicknamed her the Black Dahlia. I fantasized about the Black Dahlia at Long Beach's boardwalk, the Pike. I imagined her eating hot dogs, flirting with sailors, getting tattoos in intimate places. If that was where the Dahlia legend was born, that was where I had to be. I went to visit my sister, and within 24 hours, I had signed a 6-month lease for a beautiful apartment near Long Beach's shore. But before I could move to Dahlia land, I had a final Bay Area pilgrimage that I had to make. I asked my friend Stan to drive me to Mountain View Cemetery. We parked outside the cemetery gates, and together we walked to Elizabeth Short's grave. I had a plastic baggie with me because I knew I would be taking a souvenir. I arrived at her grave, and I knelt with her beneath me, and with my fingers, I clawed at the dirt, scooped handfuls of it, put it into the baggie, knotted it shut, and Stan and I walked to the cemetery gates. I felt apprehension at what I was doing, but I consoled myself with the thought that I had a right to this dirt. Moving day came, and it was fraught with omens that I ignored. The U-Haul that I thought that I had reserved turned out to be a Mack truck. My girlfriend had to drive because I didn't know how to. We were only supposed to drive this truck locally. About halfway down the 101, my girlfriend decided to turn on the heater. It only had one temperature, which was rotisserie. It could not be shut off. We had to roll down the windows, and we couldn't speak. We could barely see because of the wind that was tunneling through the cab. Once we arrived in Long Beach, I told her to take the Cherry Avenue exit because I knew that we lived on a fruit street. We drove down Cherry, and my girlfriend expressed some apprehension about the size of our truck and city street driving. But I said, just keep going, keep going. And as we went through an intersection, we heard a metallic ripping sound. My girlfriend pulled over and said, go check and see what that was. I hopped out of the truck's cab, and I saw a traffic light swinging. So I climbed back into the cab, and I said, drive. She said, where? And I said, straight. She asked me, which way to our home? And I answered her with silence. She looked suspiciously down at my empty hands and lap. And she said, do you have directions? And I answered her with silence. And she said, do you know where we live? And I said, I know it's a fruit street. She pulled into a strip mall parking lot and she said, get out. And don't come back till you know where we live and how to get there. I wandered the parking lot till I saw an old man who I flirted with. And beside some dumpsters, he helped me narrow down approximately where I might live and how to get there. I thanked him, returned to the cab, and I directed my girlfriend there as she snarled. When we arrived at the apartment, the electricity was not on, so we moved in by candlelight. More omens continued to come, and I began to understand what was happening. I had somehow offended the object of my obsession, and I was being haunted. My friend who had taken me to Mountain View Cemetery came to stay with us in Long Beach, and he took up temporary residence on our dining room floor. He would go to the queer bars at Broadway and Falcon and come back far after my girlfriend and I had gone to bed. One morning, while my girlfriend was out looking for work, and I was in the kitchen, he said to me, Miriam, last night I saw somebody in the living room. He said that he was lying on the living room floor and he awoke from a dream with a sense that somebody was watching him. And he looked in the doorway that leads to my bedroom and he saw a woman with dark hair, pale skin, and a black dress standing. And he couldn't see her particularly well. He had just awoken from a dream. And he thought it was me. But then he said that she began to walk across the living room and that she paused and she looked at him. And he knew that I knew who he had seen. But regardless, he said, it was the Black Dahlia. And I said to him, I have to get rid of that dirt. The dirt was in my jewelry box, along with earrings, the rosary from my first communion, and the first tab of acid that I was ever given. My girlfriend had found work at a circus near the Queen Mary. And while she was away working one night, I opened my jewelry box removed the Dahlia's dirt, and put it into my pocket. I left our apartment, walked through our ivy-filled courtyard, past the queer bars, past the Spanish-style apartment buildings with the Romeo and Juliet balconies, and I arrived at the shore. I walked down the cliffs, the stairs that are mounted into the cliffsides, and across the gray sand to the black water. I took the dirt from my pocket. I opened the baggie. I held it upside down, and I watched the Dahlia's dirt empty into the Pacific Ocean. And while her ghost did vanish, a new one was resurrected. And that was the memory of Sophia Therese. She was a woman who was murdered in a fashion similarly to the Black Dahlia. And the man who murdered her attacked me as well. I had been unable to feel any joy about my survival because somebody else had not been able to survive a murder like that. And I came to realize that the Dahlia was haunting me to encourage me to deal with my own ghosts. Thank you.
Miriam, ladies and gentlemen. It's here for all our writers tonight. Miriam, Hector, Aaron, Philip, Brenda, Ali. Stand up, writers, stand up. Take a bow. Take a bow. How about our great band here tonight, huh? These cats are swinging. And not easy to create a literary salon on a summer day, but in a library, no less. But I think we're heading off into a reception land right now and have a few drinks and our courage.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you, for coming tonight, for joining our first ever Tales of Desperation, Tales from the City of Angels. Thank you to our marvelous storytellers. Come out here in the light. Come out here. Take another bow. Thank you to our band, and thank you to Richard Montoya, and congratulations on Water and Power. Join us for the reception, and if you enjoyed tonight, please talk to us about supporting the Library Foundation so we can do more nights like this. Thank you all again for coming. Thank you, storytellers, for the gift of your stories. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Louise. Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.